It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
Every single day, CNN, MSNBC, ABC, NBC, CBS, their New York Times, Washington Post, the Democrat Party, their operatives, they attack Republicans, Trump, you, every single day. And it's not until you really understand what evil people they are, not just commentators on what they're seeing, but people with real agendas, self-dealing, sleeping together, cutting financial deals together, helping each other's careers. It's not until you understand their evil intentions that you really grasp what they're up to. And it's why they must be delegitimized. Trump understood that better than anyone. That's why he started calling them fake news at the very front end of his campaign. And even though CNN was covering every moment of everything he said that first election, they realized we have to stop covering him, because the more people see of him and hear his message, the less control and power we have. He's using us to talk to more Americans. We have to only trash him and never cover him. I want to read to you a commentary, an opinion piece that was posted by Tiana Lowe at Washington Examiner, and then I want to unpack it because it has multiple layers. Headline: Chris Cuomo said he got Alec Baldwin to spin Andrew Cuomo's sex scandal as cancel culture. Buried in New York Attorney General Letitia James's document dump on former Governor Andrew Cuomo's career-ending sex abuse scandal are text messages from the Democrats' younger brother, CNN host Chris Cuomo. The younger Cuomo, it turns out, told top Andrew Cuomo enabler Melissa De Rosa that he got actor Alec Baldwin to help spin the story in Andrew's favor. In March of this year, Chris Cuomo told De Rosa that his friend got Baldwin, currently in legal jeopardy for killing his cinematographer on set in October, to help spin the sexual harassment allegations against his brother as cancel culture. In a rambling 14-minute rant, Baldwin had attributed outsized outrage among the public to the pandemic and demanded that only after the attorney general concluded her investigation into Cuomo could we talk about people resigning. According to the transcript released by James's office, Chris Cuomo told the New York Department of Justice that both he and his brother knew Baldwin, but that actually he hadn't encouraged his diatribe in defense of the politician. Quote, I have a very good friend who is named here who called me and said, Alec wants to talk about cancel culture or political correctness, claimed Cuomo. I asked him not to. I said, tell him to stay out of it. It's not necessary. He said, well, he's going to do it, and I think it's a good idea for him to do it. He wants to talk about these things. So I said, fine. All right, well, that's my take on it. And that's what it was. And when Melissa then told me that it had happened, I was not aware. But I did know its origin. This revelation is hardly the most surprising or substantive of the treasure trove that's emerged from Albany over the past year, but it is a telling one. Even after Andrew Cuomo enacted a policy that killed upward of 10,000 seniors in nursing homes, credit to Janice Dean, the Fox meteorologist, whose in-laws were part of those who died, for keeping this issue in front of us all, lied about it, and brokered a $5 million book deal complete with taxpayer-funded labor, all while allegedly sexually abusing at least 11 women, including his own subordinates. He still had Hollywood A-listers willing to stick out their necks to defend him, and his brother, a primetime quote-unquote journalist, enabled all of it. It says a lot about the sinful and shameless nature of Hollywood, but perhaps even more about the degraded status of our humiliating, boot-licking Fourth Estate. We now know that Chris Cuomo, who every night was coming into the homes of a lot of Americans on CNN, was leading the efforts by the Cuomo team to smear the women he had sexually abused, to smear them, to destroy their reputations, and to get other people in media to say Cuomo's a great guy and we shouldn't be responding to this. Let's unpack, first of all, who Alec Baldwin is. This is a guy who more weeks than not is on Saturday Night Live because he does the Trump impression, because he's a famous liberal actor. This is a guy who, as a father, his phone conversation to his daughter was leaked. This is this kind of monster, which, if he'd been a Republican, would have been a career ender.
Hey, I want to tell you something, okay? And I want to leave a message for you right now, because, again, it's 10:30 here in New York on a Wednesday, and once again, I've made an ass of myself trying to get to a phone to call you at a specific time. When the time comes for me to make the phone call, I stop whatever I'm doing, and I go and I make that phone call at 11 o'clock in the morning in New York, and if you don't pick up the phone, at 10 o'clock at night, and you don't even have that god phone turned on. I want you to know something, okay? I'm tired of playing this game with you. I'm leaving this message with you to tell you, you have insulted me for the last time. You have insulted me. You don't have the brains or the decency as a human being. I don't give a damn that you're 12 years old or 11 years old or that you're a child or that your mother is a thoughtless pain in the ass who doesn't care about what you do as far as I'm concerned. You have humiliated me for the last time with this phone. And when I come out there next week, I'm going to fly out there for the day just to straighten you out on this issue. I'm going to let you know just how disappointed in you I am and how angry I am with you that you've done this to me again. You've made me feel like and you've made me feel like a fool over and over and over again. And this crap you pull on me with this god phone situation that you would never dream of doing to your mother, and you do it to me constantly and over again. I am going to get on a plane, and I'm going to come out there for the day, and I'm going to straighten your ass out when I see you. Do you understand me? I'm going to really make sure you get it. Then I'm going to get on a plane, I'm going to turn around, and I'm going to come home. So you better be ready Friday, the 20th, to meet with me. So I'm going to let you know just how I feel about what a rude little pig you really are. You are a rude, thoughtless little pig, okay?
Does that sound to you like a balanced man? Hey, listen, we have all had that moment, haven't we, where our child has tried our patience. This is a guy who gets into fights everywhere he goes. This is a guy who screams and hollers and loses his mind at everyone all the time. This is also a guy that the media have paraded around as the answer to all our problems. He's the greatest celebrity. This is who these people are, folks. So when Alec Baldwin comes out and tells the reporters who all love him, hey, don't worry about Andrew Cuomo. That's just the Cuomos. They're just passionate people. Even someone who might be inclined to say, this guy sounds like a sexual harasser, gives him a pass. This is how the left is living in America, and it's got to stop. They are not to be trusted ever. If they say the sky's blue, check and make sure.
Bacon is great. Michael Berry is greater. The Michael Berry Show.
5526. It's Greek to me. Ready? 1, 2, 3, 4. Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where those treetops glisten and children listen to
sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white.
It was on this day in 1957 that a little bit of radio history was made on our affiliate KEX 1190 in Portland, Oregon. There was a DJ on the station named Al Priddy, P-R-I-D-D-Y. You know, FM morning radio used to be a lot of gimmicks and games and promotions and hype. People would do crazy things long before Howard Stern was stirring it up on the radio. Well, Al Priddy in Portland, Oregon on KEX played the Elvis Presley version of White Christmas you hear there. And he was fired for it, because the program manager said it, quote, desecrates the spirit of Christmas and transgresses the composer's intent. That story would make national news, but it turned out to be a brilliant publicity stunt. Al Priddy would be back on the air 2 weeks later. The station would claim that letters were pouring in to support the DJ. As part of the stunt, Priddy recorded the GM calling in to fire him for playing the song, and played the conversation on his show before he left. A fellow named Craig Adams is a Portland radio historian, and he writes, here's the entire story in depth. The Elvis Christmas album and the firing of KEX Solid 7 disc jockey Al Priddy for playing the cut White Christmas. What led to it? What happened 30 years later? Read from Billboard magazine, the Oregonian, and Behind the Mic column accounts pertaining to this history making fib. Add to this the 1957 Elvis controversy with Irving Berlin, the composer of White Christmas. Berlin had heard Elvis's recording and called it a, quote, profane parody of his cherished Yuletide standard. Let me interrupt by saying, You think the world's gone to hell today? Your grandparents thought Elvis was edgy, and your great-grandparents thought Elvis was the devil incarnate. True. Hard to believe. Irving Berlin ordered his staff in New York to telephone radio stations across the country demanding that Elvis's White Christmas and the entire album be banned from radio airwaves. And Irving Berlin was a very powerful man at the time. Billboard magazine, October 7th, 1957. Huge advance on Elvis LP New York. RCA Victor's deluxe Elvis Presley Christmas album, which will retail at $4.98, has already chalked up distributor orders far in excess of the label's planned production of 200,000 copies, according to RCA Victor album department chief W.W. Bullock. The exec terms it the greatest advance album order in the history of the company. However, Bullock said there are still no plans at present to increase production of the LP-tagged Elvis's Christmas album. The special set spotlights 9 12x12 four-color photos of Presley, along with a full page of Presley Candids. EP versions of the LP will also be made available. You know how you know that story is dated 1957? Because they refer to him as Presley. He's never referred to as Presley after that. He's Elvis. He's one name. Behind the Mic, dated November 8, 1957. Most nauseating news of this or any other Christmas season is that Elvis has discovered Christmas. His new album of Christmas songs just out contains most of the classics, but his rock and roll treatment of White Christmas proved just too much for Mel Bailey, KEX program director, who banned it from the air as far as KEX is concerned. We expect to hear many protests from Presley fans, but we wouldn't play this record if we had 10,000 requests. Time magazine called the album a crime against Christmas, all of which should guarantee it'll be on the top 10 overnight. Well, in addition, the story goes through and they talk about how awful it was and how awful Elvis was. And it goes on to quote, "As program manager of the station, I feel Presley's rendition of White Christmas extremely vulgar. It desecrates the spirit of Christmas and transgresses the composer's intent, as well as all the Christmas traditions so many of us hold dear. Other numbers in the album are not being restricted. While I don't personally care for Mr. Presley, he is possessed of a certain talent and appeal, and so long as he abides by even average standards of good taste, we'll play his records and let the public decide if they like them. I sincerely hope you'll convey this information to your readers." What a scam, what a game, what a gimmick! Well, he pulled it off. He pulled it off. And then there is the phone call. There is the supposedly surreptitiously recorded phone call where he is fired. And then that's made public. And then supposedly the public is upset and they write letters and they say, "Bring Al Pretty back. We stand with Al Pretty and we stand with Elvis. The times have changed, and we want Mr. Pretty on the air, and we want to hear Elvis's White Christmas." And the program director says, "I won't have it. I won't hear of it. He is slandering the good name of Christmas by making it too rock and roll. And you kids today can demand all you want, but I won't have it. The times are not a-changing. I won't have it. It's not good for America. I'm for the old way of doing business, and I'm for Christmas in its original form. But the calls are coming, the letters are coming, and we're going to reconsider, and we're going to put Mr. Pretty back on the air." And that was a simpler time, indeed. 54 years ago today, Elvis's White Christmas was supposedly really, really raunchy, randy stuff. Wouldn't you like to go back to those times? With inflation in full effect, and people feel it at the pump, President Biden is now blaming high gas prices on big oil. And he's ordered the Federal Trade Commission to look into possible shenanigans, he says.
"I've asked the Federal Trade Commission to consider whether potentially illegal and anti-competitive behavior in the oil and gas industry is causing higher prices to be maintained for consumers when the overall cost of oil is down. India, Japan, the Republic of Korea, the United Kingdom all joined us. They all agreed to release additional oil from the reserves, and China may be doing so as well. This worldwide effort we're leading will not solve the problem of high gas prices overnight, but it has been making a difference."
The Michael Berry Show.
Got a woman, she
there
loved
is a
me.
Frequently used offhanded joke that is on some of the social media sites that whatever boondoggle, whatever wasteful expenditure government wants to make, that it is referred to as infrastructure. And for those of you not on social media, you're not missing anything. But the reference there is that Joe Biden's big massive omnibus bill to hand out to all his Democrat constituencies is referred to as infrastructure because you get the media to tell that story and everybody says, "Oh, well, I don't want the bridges to be falling down and I don't want the roads to be busted open and the overpasses to crumble. So however much money they need, that's fine." Well, that's like saying I'm for a strong national defense and paying for a $700 toilet. No. You don't have to have wasteful expenditure in order to have effective, efficient government. Unfortunately, that doesn't make for very sexy headlines. So here to be very unsexy is Jonathan Bidlack, director of the governance program at the R Street Institute. He also oversees the fiscal and budget policy project in the Legislative Branch Capacity Working Group, and he's a creator of SpendTracker.org, because guess what? We need a few adults in the room to bring some sanity to all this nonsense. Jonathan, I'm just going to ask you an open-ended question. How bad is the infrastructure bill? How bad is that for us? How much damage does this do? Because it ain't infrastructure, we know that.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. That was quite the introduction. So, you know, it's important to separate it out. I mean, obviously, there are two bills here, right? There's the one that already passed, and then there's the one that's in the works. And it's the one that's in the works that's really the most troubling. I mean, I think that, you know, people across the political aisle acknowledge that, you know, you have to pay to pave the roads and build the bridges and that sort of thing. Although, of course, you know, the supposed poor state of our infrastructure has largely been exaggerated. But when you look at what's now being talked about in this new, you know, reconciliation package, which the Congressional Budget Office has estimated is, I think it's an additional $1.6 trillion in spending. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there, as you're pointing out, that is not at all related to infrastructure. And in fact, that's the reason why they split these bills up to begin with, because they knew that, you know, there would be some level of bipartisan support for the more traditional infrastructure items. But, you know, this second bill is largely a, you know, it's a grab bag or a wish list of you know, Democratic priorities where, you know, frankly, there's obviously no Republican support, but they're also struggling to get Democratic support because, you know, the size of the package is so large. Obviously, there's concern about inflation. And frankly, there's just not agreement within the Democratic caucus that all of these things are good ideas that they even want to see.
How do we stop this? I know that goes beyond, you know, sort of where we started, but it strikes me that, you know, there used to be a very, you know, Grover used to do a great job with the sort of taxpayer's perspective. But it feels like we're arguing about a lot of things, vaccine mandates among them. We're arguing about a lot of things, but the taxpayer doesn't really have a lobbyist. And every one of these excessive expenditures does.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, at the end of the day, there needs to be a realignment or a rethinking of our view of what the proper size and scope of government should be. I mean, you know, we have, I think, too many people who sort of look to government and specifically look to the federal government for a lot of this stuff. And frankly, the problems that we're seeing, whether they're sort of the, you know, the economic issues, the inflation and so on that we're dealing with, well, there's a reason why that's happening. And it's because we've been spending a lot of money without really thinking about the consequences. Because I think that for too long, you know, a lot of policymakers have taken this, you know, have this idea that we don't really need to worry about this, that we can spend on whatever we want and we don't need to worry about there being potential consequences. And, you know, now, of course, you know, with people being concerned about inflation, that's obviously one form. But, you know, over time, I mean, these things, you know, they cost a lot of money and they either have to be paid back in one way or another, right? Whether it's going to be higher taxes down the road or things that we have to forgo in the future that we won't be able to afford. And so, you know, I always like to say that you know, rethinking government spending is the core issue, because if you actually get spending under control and you sort of, you know, get people to understand that, you know, what these consequences are, well, I mean, what's your incentive to raise taxes at that point? You don't need to raise taxes if you don't have something that you need to pay for. You don't need to worry about, you know, the Federal Reserve, you know, tinkering with interest rates because there's no sort of fiscal policy that they really need to be accommodating. And so a lot of the things that we're talking about now, you know, the debt limit is another great example. This discussion over whether or not we should raise the debt limit. Well, we wouldn't need to be raising the debt limit all the time if we were actually living within our means. So a lot of these discussions that we're having in the political realm really at the root come back to the fact that we're ultimately spending more money than we have.
Funny you say that. I spoke earlier in preparation for an interview we did today with the author of The Millionaire Next Door. In The Fundamental Rule, it came out in 1996. Fundamental rule to becoming a net worth of $1 million or more is spend less than you make. I mean, this idea, if people don't do it in their personal lives, then of course they don't demand it of their government, do they?
Well, that's just it, you know, and obviously there are differences between government and your personal, you know, finances. But I think the analogy is still generally a good one. And I think most Americans, you know, get it at sort of a very, you know, instinctive level. Now, you know, we don't always necessarily go and apply it. As soon as we start talking about, you know, public policy, I think that there are people, frankly, on both sides of the aisle who always want to have their thing be funded and not really think about where that funding is coming from. And so, you know, if you're talking about Democrats, right, it's a lot of this, you know, non-defense social spending that we're seeing, you know, that we're discussing now. But if you're talking about Republicans, you know, you tend to see, you know, really aggressive, you know, Pentagon spending or spending overseas. And so, you know, these things may be worthwhile expenditures, right? We can have that debate. But really where we should be starting is with this agreement that if we are going to spend, we should make sure that we're doing so in a way that's responsible and is consistent with sort of, you know, fiscal prudence, because this is how we get into the problem that we have right now. And you know, I should add that you know, the challenge here is it's not just about the national debt or the things that we've already spent on. It's all these promises that we're making in the future, you know, these entitlement programs that really are not sustainable and at some point in time we'll have to deal with them, just as other countries have had to deal with them. You know, there's emergencies, things that come up that we didn't foresee that we're in a worse position to be able to cope with, you know, the pandemic being obviously the most recent example, but, you know, we've seen wars in the past. We've seen, you know, the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. So at its core, I mean, our fiscal, you know, having our fiscal house in order is really a national security issue. And it's something that, you know, I think both sides, again, really need to go and grapple with.
I'm up against a break. I wish I wasn't. Come back again. Jonathan Bidlack is director of the governance program at the R Street Institute. I said spendtracker.org earlier. It's actually spendingtracker.org. Go there and spend 10 minutes. You'll be back visiting every day. It's fascinating stuff.
The Michael Berry Show.
Oh, Michael Berry.
One of the great checks, one of the great breaks on the power of the federal government as part of federalism is the power of the state to push back and regulate and deny and object. Our Attorney General in the state of Texas, Ken Paxton, is leading the charge across the country in doing that, and he's our guest now. The arguments in the Dobbs case, the abortion case before the Supreme Court yesterday, any surprises, any thoughts on that?
You know, not really. I just say this. I'm excited that we played a big role in that. We filed the amicus brief on behalf of 24 states to support the concept that Roe v. Wade should no longer be valid because the Supreme Court has not done a good job of dealing with the issue. The rules constantly change. States don't know what the rules are. It should be left to the voters to elect people that make those decisions. And the Supreme Court has a really bad track record of managing this issue, and they shouldn't be in that business.
You expect the case to prevail 5-4?
You know what? I'm really hopeful. I am really hopeful. I'm praying. I don't think anybody really knows whether these justices have the courage to overturn something that shouldn't be in place. It wasn't a constitutional right. They made it up. Even those who support it, who were honest about what the court did, there was no precedent for it. There was no law for it. They made it up, and they shouldn't be doing that. Judges shouldn't be doing that. That's not their role in the constitutional form of government that we have. And I'm just praying that the justice, at least five of them, have the courage to do the right thing and let it go back to the states to make that decision.
Considering we have a 6-3 majority, we can still give up one and win 5-4. It's sad that it comes to that when that's an issue you would expect folks to be able to vote their conscience on. But I guess we will wait and see. The newest variant of COVID, which appears to be, according to a doctor in South Africa who first discovered it, not much more than the common cold. We've now had our first American, according to Fauci, to have the Omicron variant, which, of course, there are plenty more that had it, just didn't get tested, and that individual was vaccinated. Expectation that the Biden administration will try more lockdowns, crackdowns, and invasive, intrusive laws, and you'll fight them again, I suppose.
Absolutely. I mean, we always want to look at what they put in writing, because what they say a lot of times doesn't match with what they actually do. And so we're very cautious about what we say prior to anything being written, put in writing. But definitely, if we believe that they've overstepped their constitutional role or their statutory role, we'll fight them tooth and nail.
How is that going so far? Because I know that you spend a good portion of your time these days, anyway, fighting the Biden administration's national declarations and not allowing them to be imposed in Texas.
Yeah, I think at this point we have about 21 lawsuits with the Biden administration. Three of them are over the mask, or not the mask, but the vaccine mandate. We filed the first one related to OSHA, and we were successful in getting a stay at the Fifth Circuit to stop the vaccine requirement for employers that are over 100. We have two other lawsuits. Other states have already been successful. We're waiting for our day in court. We actually have a day in court today related to the one related to healthcare workers to try to protect them. And then we've got another one related to federal contractors. So we're fighting it on all the fronts. And so far, the other states that have been a part of this, we've all been successful in stopping this as we've moved our way up. So in the end, I'm guessing we'll be at the Supreme Court and hopeful that the Supreme Court will rule the correct way. Because in reality, if the Biden administration can force an employer to force you as an employee to make a decision between a job and your health, then there's nothing that the federal government can't order you to do, and then we're really in trouble.
The term slippery slope is too often used, but in this case, it is exactly, you are exactly right. General Paxton, on the issue of federal contractors and whether the government can do this, I understand an appellate court stayed that action a few days ago. Is this in addition to that, or is that not applicable here? Where is that issue?
Yeah, so that one was, I believe, so hard to keep track of all these cases. That one, I believe, was out of Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee. And that circuit applied that ruling, I believe, just to that circuit. So we've got our own case that we're waiting for a ruling on that very, very issue.
Is
and we're
this
hoping
in the Fifth
that
Circuit?
We can set precedent. Yeah, so okay. Ours is actually still waiting for a ruling from the from the district judge, but we are in the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah. Okay. I think, so I'm sure you get a lot of questions from people who want you to be their private lawyer or the attorney general to answer their questions. But what I have told companies is, look, you don't have to impose these mandates. They're being fought in the courts. That's where, as you said, the Biden administration says things publicly that are, you know, over the top, you better comply or you're going to jail businesses, but then they can't do that in writing because it won't stand up in court. And a lot of people don't know the difference. So they're complying with what's nothing more than a news story, right?
Yeah, Michael, you hit it, the nail on the head. And I've been trying to tell companies the same thing. You do not have to follow these. We are winning. We are fighting for you in court. We're fighting for these companies to have the ability to make their own decision. We're fighting for these employees to have control over their own bodies and still have a job. So I would, again, just beg companies, do not capitulate, do not give in. If you look at the impact on these companies, I mean, it's going to be very, very negative, whether it's transportation with pilots or whether it's healthcare or whether it's first responders. We can't afford to lose these people. I know these companies don't want to lose these people, so why capitulate to something that's going to harm your company and harm your employees?
Fear. A lot of businesses are fearful, and I think that they simply act out of fear against their better judgment. And as you know, most people are not willing to fight back. I've got a minute and a half. I want to make sure we get to this. What is the state of the border? I know you're doing everything you can within the power of the Attorney General's office to enforce our border laws and keep our state safe. What's the update?
So I'm still, we're still in that fight. They're supposedly re-implementing the Stay in Mexico program within the next week or so. We're going to be carefully watching that. We filed a motion to enforce because that's one of the primary ways that the Trump administration cut illegal immigration to a much smaller number. And it's the way that the Biden administration, by undoing it, really allowed for massive number of people to come across the border. So I think that's an important step. And if they actually implement that, I think we'll start making progress along the border like we haven't made since Biden's been in office.
Well, I know that you are going to do everything in your power to ensure that that is the case. You've done a wonderful job. Attorney General Ken Paxton, thank you for being our guest.
Hey, Michael, thank you and have a great day.
Thank you, bud. You know, there are a lot of Republicans that get elected by showing up at the 4th of July parade wearing their lapel pin, saying the right words, offering balanced budgets and prayer in school, and we need to bring back value, but they never actually do anything. It's just talk. And the talk is designed to make you think, oh, he's just like me. He's going to fight for us, when they're not going to fight anything. They are going to get elected, and then they're going to defend the Democrats or say that we should be more civilized or say that – or basically undercut everything Trump tried to do and insult everyone who supports Trump, because that's unpleasant. That's uncivilized, all while the left slits our throat. I'm done with those types of Republicans.
It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
Are in a restaurant and a guy comes strolling in and he's got a wad of cash and he's got gold around his neck and an expensive suit. Maybe he pulled up in a Lambo or a Ferrari and he's talking big and yelling into his phone and he's giving off every vibe that he's rich. And the reason he's doing that is he's trying to swindle someone out of their money. He's trying to make them make a bad decision because, well, you can't question this guy. He's obviously rich and successful. And sadly, that works. You know, there's a show that CNBC does called American Greed, and they'll have these swindlers, these absolute scam artists, and it's almost always the same. They give the impression of making a lot of money because that convinces people, well, they're making a lot of money. They must be smart. When in fact, usually they're not only not smart, they're not even making a lot of money. And people take leave of their senses when they see these silly things. In 1996, a book came out, and I remember it absolutely rocked the world. It was called The Millionaire Next Door by the late Thomas J. Stanley and William D. Danko. William D. Danko, Ph.D. And I remember at the time, it's like Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Occasionally, there's something that becomes famous for all the right reasons, sort of the anti-Kardashian. It's famous. It's being talked about. It's important because it's a back to basics. It's a, hey, look, these are the solid fundamentals. Well, William D. Danko, since that time, has co-authored another book called Richer Than a Millionaire, A Pathway to True Prosperity, which is about, you know, purpose and building wealth. And I wanted to have him on the show. I've wanted to have him on the show for a very long time because I really don't care how much money you have, how much money you save, how much money you retire with. But I do think it's important to understand that most of the images being marketed to you on the television are glitz and glamour and gloss without real fundamentals behind them. And good decisions are often not the decisions that get the note of the neighbors, but are solid decisions for the long time, for the long term. William D. Danko, Dr. William D. Danko, is our guest, and I'm honored to have you. Take me, if you would, back to the writing of The Millionaire Next Door, because I'm guessing at the time you had no idea how that book would be received.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for having me on here. You know, it really started in 1973. When I was a student in a marketing class as an undergraduate student, and a young assistant professor, Thomas J. Stanley, taught a course. And it was just another ordinary marketing course, but it turned out to be an extraordinary marketing course. I got an A in the class, and he invited me to participate and help him with his very first study of the affluent market. And this is pretty heady stuff. So he encouraged me to then go on for my MBA and my PhD. And over a 20-year period since 1973 to 1993, we had done a number of marketing research studies. We did some academic studies as well as consulting studies. But he called me up. He had since gone to another school. I became a professor at an upstate New York university. And he said, Bill, here's a concept. Think about this. Big hat, no cattle. And I said, huh. Well, I can see kind of a meaning there, but he went on to explain. He says, there's a lot of folks out there who have a lot of money who don't show it. And alternatively, and conversely, there are a lot of people who look like they have a lot of money. They have the big hat, but they have no substance. So really, so 20 years of research and, you know, our academic and consulting studies, he came up with this idea. I said, let's look at this from who the true wealth holders are in America. So after 20 years, as I said, it was an overnight success, right?
You know, in the state of Texas, where I am, I know you're in upstate in New York, where our listeners are listening in on WGY. In the state of Texas, the term all hat, no cattle, or big hat, no cattle, has a lot of meaning because there are plenty of folks who are trying to give the impression that, whether it's in the ranching industry or not, Conway Twitty had a great song called Don't Call Him a Cowboy Till You've Seen Him Ride, because that Stetson hat and those cowboy boots don't tell you what's inside. It's sort of after the urban cowboy era. There were lots of guys walking around acting like a cowboy that couldn't figure out how to get up on a horse. But when you started digging deeper into, you know, where's the cattle? Where's the delivery? What's the financial status? Because it's not about financial status for the sake of having more than the next guy. It's about comfort and security of stability. How did you start building into that? How did you start the data set of the millionaire next door? How did you begin digging in? Because I remember reading about the guy that had the, you know, the little dinky car and the little dinky house, and he had $1 million in the bank, and the guy next to him had the, whatever it was, the Cadillac or the Continental and the big house, and he had nothing in the bank. And that hit home to me, and that was pretty early on in the book.
Yeah, no, exactly. Again, through the survey research method, you know, you get these mailing lists of the so-called affluent markets, and there's spillover into other geographic areas in any mailing list. And what we're finding is there are some people who lived in some pretty swanky neighborhoods who had wall-to-wall mortgages, lots of student debt, maybe because they're a physician or an attorney, and yeah, they have a leased car. I mean, they look good in the sense of they have the fancy house, the fancy car, but you don't know that they have this tremendous amount of debt that is supporting all of this. And consequently, they have handcuffs on. They have to keep working and keep on this economic treadmill. And on the other hand, you get some folks who are, plumbers or carpenters or junkyard owners. They live in many times what we call the industrial strength neighborhood. they don't drive the fancy car. They probably drive a pickup truck. They don't have to impress anybody. They don't need the $1,000 or $2,000 suits. They have their work clothes. They make a great living. You can call them maybe blue collar millionaires if you want. But what we have found is that there are so many people that you might even call them the hidden millionaires, where social status is not part of their mindset. Where on the other hand, there's a lot of social status in certain neighborhoods, and it's the so-called keeping up with the Joneses mentality.
What is your net worth? Stop and calculate that for a moment. And how do you get to be the millionaire next door? We continue our conversation with Bill Danko, the author of that best-selling book, coming up next.
The Michael Berry Show.
The Millionaire Next Door 25 years ago, and I wanted to bring you the author to share some of his wisdom. And we do that now, Dr. William D. Danko, Bill Danko. The book is The Millionaire Next Door. It came out in 96. He's since written Richer Than a Millionaire. But what you're really talking about is what we call, what we teach our kids to avoid, and that is peer pressure, right? Peer pressure from the time we're in 6th grade, 8th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade. How many girls get pregnant by a boy because of the peer pressure of, well, he'll dump me if I don't have sex with him, and I have to be dating the quarterback, or I have to be dating the star player, or I have to be dating the school, you know, most handsome. I mean, this is fraternities, sororities, clubs, associations, country clubs. It follows us our whole lives. Get off of worrying what other people think about you, and you'll be a lot better off, especially in your finances.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. You know, I was a university professor for 34 years. I'm now emeritus, but I taught marketing and marketing research and marketing strategy. And the questions we always talked about was, what does a marketer have to do to extract money from a client? Okay. I mean, that's just the way marketing works. You know, how do we create pressures and expectations? And it really becomes insidious, doesn't it? But we live in such a consumer driven society that we always think that bigger, faster, more, new, all those words is something that we need. And of course, we don't need any of that stuff. What we need is peace of mind.
Let's go back. Bill, for those folks who haven't read The Millionaire Next Door and they just, you know, there were a lot of references over the years and people kind of offhandedly read it and may not have dug deep. Talk a little bit about what you found, what the data showed over a period of, and you had a pretty extensive data set, as I recall. The beauty of being academics, you can do that. Is what you found in people who were quote-unquote millionaires. And, of course, 25 years ago, being a millionaire was a bigger deal than it is today. But it's still just as true, just more digits, more zeros. Talk a little bit about what patterns you found in these people.
Yeah. Well, first of all, $1 million net worth is still a pretty substantial net worth. When you realize right now, at least as of last year with federal data, the median net worth of an American household is $120,000. That's the 50th percentile. So if you have more than $120,000 in net worth, and that's your assets minus liabilities, you know, if you have more than that, you're in the top half of the household distribution in the United States.
Bill, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm going to interrupt you because with radio, people don't get to see numbers. I want to make sure everyone understands. Median means not average. It means half are above and half are below. And that's not annual income. He's talking about your actual net worth. So if you owe $1 million on a house, but you only have $900,000 in assets, you don't have a positive net worth. You have a negative net worth. And 120 is not very much in net worth.
No, it's not. And in fact, and that's including your car, your pension plan, your savings, your net worth in your house. So $1 million of net worth still is pretty substantial, even in this time frame. But let me get back to some of the building blocks here. You know, it really comes down to what made these wealthy people wealthy. They worked, they saved, and they invested. Now, frugality is really the cornerstone here, and it's a term we use called self-imposed economic scarcity. You know, we were talking about peer pressure. Well, you have to do what you feel is right and don't go by what all the societal pressure is telling you to do. And so how these wealthy people became wealthy is with this self-imposed economic scarcity, saying, you know, I don't need a new car every year. What's wrong with buying a slightly depreciated car and get the gift of early depreciation from the previous owner? Or do I really need custom-made suits? What's wrong with buying off the rack? What we have found consistently in our surveys, for every wealthy person who can afford a luxury item, there are 4 to 5 others buying the same item because they want to look wealthy. Well, you can either look wealthy or be wealthy. And so if you can get this mindset of whatever you make, live on 80% of it and consistently save 20% of your income, and the earlier you start, the better off you will be. So you have to be a worker, making money, living below your means, saving 20%, and then investing consistently over time. And that's really one of the key elements here. You know, in 1985, a Nobel winner, Franco Modigliani, he won his prize in economics for something called the life cycle of money. And when you hear what it is, you say, boy, that's pretty obvious. Well, he demonstrates that it's true. And essentially what he does is shows that when you're young, you work for money, and when you're old, money works for you. What happens is we get on this earn and spend mentality. It's much like the federal government, I suppose. But for your own personal household, if you can get it through your head to be a consistent saver and let time work for you and have compound interest work for you, you'll certainly be on your path to building wealth. In fact, most people can do this if they just have the discipline to do it.
You know, it's sort of like a diet. I just lost 70 pounds and people will come up to me in the hallway or in different places where I meet them and they'll say, wow, you look great. How much weight have you lost? 70 pounds. What did you do? And so I go through the fundamentals of what I've done to lose the weight, and they give me the 10 reasons that won't work, doesn't work, that's bad for you. They give me, and it's sort of like, look, I think what you wanted to hear me say is I sang a song and stood on my leg for 30 seconds and watched a lot of TV. You want a quick fix, and there's not a quick fix. What The Millionaire Next Door is about is the fundamentals of living your life differently than your neighbors are, because most Americans are in deep debt for a reason. And it's making decisions that are not glamorous or simple or overnight fixes that make all the difference in the world. I mean, and that's not what people want to hear.
Yeah, no, they don't. But, you know, there are some fundamental truths. You know, in the Bible, the book of Proverbs, chapter 22, verse 7, it was written 2,500 years ago. But there's a phrase in there that rings true today. The borrower is a slave to the lender. When you're in debt and you have to keep paying your, those student loans off, you're a slave. You're a slave. You know, in fact, there was a recent Wall Street Journal article about professional school debt and how it's not uncommon, for example, going to a veterinary school to accrue maybe $400,000 in student loans and living expenses. And then when you realize that when you start work, you're not going to even make even close to that. But once you start paying off your debt, in fact, there was this one woman veterinarian who said, look, I have this $400,000, and if I keep on this same paying program in 20 years, because of the interest on the loan, I'm going to still owe $700,000. I mean, many times we put ourselves into these positions of saying, isn't it great to go get a certain degree or live in a certain house or practice a certain lifestyle? But when you realize there's a cost associated with it and you become, well, a slave to the lender, here in debtor's prison, so to speak.
We continue our conversation with Bill Danko coming up next.
The Michael Berry Show.
How do you get to be the millionaire next door? We continue our conversation with Bill Danko, the author of that best-selling book. I'm 51. I started college in 1989, and I'll never forget because it struck me. My dad didn't do credit cards. In 1989, my dad did not own a credit card. And when he finally did, it was a Discover card. And the minute he made a charge, he'd come home and write a check to him, mail it off. And that was only because there were certain things that you needed a credit card for. But that was years later. I remember distinctly going to college and going to the University Center my first day there, and there were credit card companies set up. And I went over and I said, what are y'all doing here? I'm a college freshman. I want to learn what's going on. I'm interested. You know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. You qualify for a credit card right now. And it was some insane amount of money, like $3,000. And I'm 18 with no income as a college student. And I'm thinking, how do I qualify? You're a student. And it's this idea that you're hooked in to this debt before you ever know it. But it's thrilling at the time. I didn't do it, but it's thrilling at the time to think about. But that's what people, they're graduating high school, college, not just with student loan debt, but with credit card debt that is oppressive.
Yeah. And again, we bring it on ourselves. Well, the marketers help convince us that we should be doing it. And this is one of the evils. Look, I love America. There's no question about it. We live in the greatest country in the world. But sometimes I think our spending habits get out of hand. And I think if individuals become more disciplined, like, yeah, I congratulate you for losing the weight. There's no question. You know, I have a whole shelf full of diet books. I know exactly what to do. But doing it is really a key here. You know, related to this, you know, in The Millionaire Next Door, we do a nice contrast and compare of those people who earn their own wealth versus those who inherit it. And what do you suppose we find? Well, we find that 80% of the first generation wealthy, are first generation. And those who inherit their wealth just don't have the same drive as the previous generation had. You know, what we find is when we look at wristwatches, suits of clothing, houses, cars, everything that goes on with life, in every single category, the inheritors spend more than those who actually earned themselves. You know, once you have that skin in the game earning it, you say, maybe I should be a little more cautious here. Maybe I really should say, do I really need, you know, this $5,000 wristwatch when a $50 one will suffice? And of course, they both tell time. But why and who are you trying to impress?
You know, that is such a deep, profound question that I think being introspective is important, because I talk to my boys are teenagers, and we talk a lot about when you make a mistake, why did you make that mistake? Why did you say something that you knew was not the right thing to say at that time? If you're honest with yourself, were you trying to impress someone else? Were you trying to impress a girl who you think is cute, or your buddy who you thought would laugh? Why were you being the class clown? Why were you being disrespectful? Why is that person acting that way? And I think when you can start drilling down and understanding, hey, why did I buy a vehicle I can't afford? Why did I buy this big house in this neighborhood? Why did I spend money I didn't have? Was it to impress this other person? Because then we're getting to the deeper question of why we make mistakes. And it's usually for a reason like that. The book is The Millionaire Next Door. It came out in 1996. We talked to a lot of folks who've written a recent book, but I've been wanting to do this interview for a long, long time because I see people making this mistake. More recently, he wrote Richer Than a Millionaire, A Pathway to True Prosperity. Bill Danko, let me go back and ask you a question. When you look at some of the behaviors of The Millionaire Next Door, what were some of those that stuck out to you that to this day when you give speeches and when people ask you are very simple but kind of define who this person is?
Yeah. You know, one of the best compliments is, I'll see some, they identify themselves as mothers of teenage children. And they said, you know, The Millionaire Next Door book was the best Christmas present I gave my children because it said the things that I have to tell them, but I didn't know how to tell them. And it really showed that these are the basic lessons. Look, there's an adage, how does a train run best when it's on its tracks? You know, we have a lot of train wrecks in society. People become, you know, involved in the relative moralism. You know, they really have no guidelines. They just do what they want to do when they want to do it. And of course, that's a recipe for disaster. And unfortunately, it's sometimes parents who help enable their young children by not giving that kind of guidance. Again, getting back to The Millionaire Next Door, one of the chapters is about economic outpatient care, and it's about parents who coddle their children and create a sense of entitlement. Well, what happens when you have an adult child who still feels entitled? Warren Buffett really had a good idea about how to cure this. You know, okay, you're an affluent family. You don't want to deprive your children. But Buffett says this: give your children enough so that they can do anything, but not so much they can do nothing. So help them have this intergenerational transfer of wealth, but don't subsidize a lifestyle that they can't easily maintain on their own. And again, it's a good life lesson. And also, another key lesson is there's really no such thing as a bad job if you do it very well. I mean, I talked about like junk dealers. Well, there's money to be made. There was a recent obituary in the Wall Street Journal for a guy named Wayne Hughes. He was a billionaire at his death. But how did he start? He said after he graduated from college in 1957, he was driving around California and he saw some pretty shabby storage units. And he said to himself and his partner, you know, why don't we build storage units? Well, he did. And he says, you know what? There's no toilets. There's no replacing carpets. You don't have to evict anybody. It's just one unit at a time. It's all hard work, one unit after one unit. You know, and you become a billionaire by being in the real estate business, by just having an idea of people have a lot of junk to store,
yep,
and I know how to help them. So there are a lot of clever people out there who have nothing to do with technology or, you know, the arts or the sciences, but they know how to solve a problem at a profit. And that's really the basis for so many people who have built tremendous amounts of wealth.
The Michael Berry Show.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want.
This is Shirley Q. Liquor, and I appreciate y'all giving me airtime to express my point of view, as I am the voice of democracy for everybody who stay on my side of town. We is going to have a protest march this Saturday at 12 or later, whenever people wake up and get down there. Due to the fact of, you know what we noticed, there ain't no black people on no money. They got this latest lady on there from Peru or Puerto Rico or something, with her baby on her back, look like she need change for WIC, made a gold coin out this lady. And there, black lady up on there, we could put Al Sharpton on a dollar, put Jesse Jackson on a five, put O.J. Simpkins on a 10. Oh, you got plenty of black peoples to pick from that would be pretty on a dollar. Except all them white men. Every one of them got white hair. Well, they do have that one lady on the dollar bill. $1 bill, Barbara Bush. I like her. She all right. Oh, well, we'll see you at the rally. Tell your mama I say how she doing. Tell her bring all her money with her. We taking a collection. Bye, honey.
Occasionally, we step back from the news of the day, and I try to bring you things that might actually make your life better. I read The Millionaire Next Door 25 years ago, and I wanted to bring you the author to share some of his wisdom. And we do that now, Dr. William D. Danko, Bill Danko. I don't know that self-storage is such a brilliant idea per se. It is more an unglamorous necessity. That's a lot of blocking and tackling to get to being a billionaire, because that means you had to be there to receive every person who wanted to rent it. You had to burn them. You had to cut them a key. You had to make sure the place was safe. You had to make sure that you constructed it. I mean, it's a lot of execution of simple tasks. People want to make it big in an overnight grand idea, whereas the real money is in the car washes and the self-storage and the things that don't look so glamorous because they take a lot of work, but they're solid and they'll always be there.
Yeah, or renting billboards or having parking spaces downtown in some city. You know, charging people $50 a day to park their car on a flat piece of property. I mean, you know, look, we don't want to pave America, but my point is there's lots of simple ways that people have capitalized on. And on the other hand, you know, look, we need, you know, medical doctors for sure, and we need professionals. But when you look at the debt they incur, and you have to ask yourself, how many are actually making it big and enjoying what they're doing, or are they just on a treadmill, just trying to keep up a lifestyle, and as soon as they retire, because they have no savings and investments, they have nothing. You know, it's quite a shock to the system.
Let me ask you this, but, Bill Danko. It's been 25 years since, 26 actually, since you wrote, you and Thomas Stanley, the late Thomas Stanley, wrote The Millionaire Next Door. Are there things you wish you had included that you didn't, that you would update it?
Yeah.
Or are there things that have changed?
Well, you know, in 1996, when the book came out, was also a pivotal year in my life. You know, and it was on a personal side. Now, The Millionaire Next Door was very good. It gave me a lot of speaking opportunities, lots of royalties. It sold more than 4 million copies. It still sells. It's a perennial bestseller. It's wonderful. God bless America. But one thing it doesn't talk about in the book is really charity and a greater purpose of having the money. So getting back to 1996, my mother had a major stroke, and I tell you this because she was the primary caregiver to my quadriplegic brother. And when she could no longer care for him, my wife and I became the primary caregivers to my brother. We kept him out of a nursing home. We bought him a house, all wheelchair accessible. But for a 20-year period, basically every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I was his personal health care aide because, one, it's very hard to get personal health care aides on a reliable basis, and two, you know, somebody had to do some house maintenance like myself and cut the grass. But I got to talk to a guy, my brother, who, as a quadriplegic, couldn't even scratch his nose. Feed him, bathe him, dress him. I loved him dearly. And here I am, you know, university professor, PhD, you know, doing quite well economically, enjoying good health. And starting to read some, you know, philosophical books and, you know, exploring the meaning of life and things of that nature, I came across, or reread, I should say, an essay from Benjamin Franklin. It was written in 1758, titled The Way to Wealth. And in that essay, it's about 3,500 words, and I encourage anybody to do a Google search, The Way to Wealth. He wrote it under the pseudonym Richard Saunders, as in Poor Richard's Almanac. But in his essay, he says, look, it's good to be industrious and frugal and focused and create a living where you can generate money. But he says, it's all blasted without a blessing of heaven. So don't forget to be charitable to those who are in need. So he says, if you really want to become wealthy, yeah, money is important. But money and being generous with your time, your treasure, your talents, and helping others will truly make you wealthy. And that really became the key driving force of my colleague, Rich Van Ness, who is a few years older than I, but he's a former Marine. And he says, you know, look, Bill, let's go on an excursion here and develop this into a book. I said, oh, boy. You know, so again, a couple of old guys getting back to the survey research and the writing. But it's, but I know it's the truth that is so important that we reveal in our research, Richer Than a Millionaire, which, like Millionaire Next Door is available at Amazon.com most easily, but also richerthanamillionaire.com. You can find out more about it.
Followed by the phrase that I think is the real purpose, Richer Than a Millionaire, A Pathway to True Prosperity, which is more than just the accumulation of wealth. Bill Danko, I'm up against a break. You are a great guest. We'll have you back. The book is The Millionaire Next Door. He did a follow-up called Richer Than a Millionaire, A Pathway to True Prosperity. The thing I took from that book at the time, and still do to this day, spend less than you earn. It's a very simple way to live your life, and most people don't do it. There's plenty of free cash out there, but it's not free. You're borrowing it, and you're going to have to pay it back in the future. And don't make purchases based on the fact that they're glamorous or glitzy. Buy less than you can afford, and you'll have more left tomorrow. Have a good one.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. Thank you, and good night.